Welcome back. This is the Coaches Rising podcast, and I am delighted today to be joined by Robert Diggings. He is a highly successful executive coach and team development consultant, and I wanted to invite him onto the podcast to explore why is he in such demand and what is the work that he's actually doing with teams. So we will unpack what kinds of frameworks does Robert hold, what kind of moves does he make with the teams that he works with. We'll explore topics such as what he sees as the key for effective teams, how we can enable higher team coherence, and what are the four main emotions he supports his clients to master. So as I said, Robert is an executive coach, a team development consultant. He draws on integrative trainings such as Gestalt, organizational constellations, systems coaching, the Enneagram, and the Diamond Approach. And he's spent thousands of hours working with individuals and teams, including clients such as Network Rail, the BBC, Travelodge, Jaguar Land Rover, Capital One, and Leon Restaurants. So we are in safe hands with this topic. So that all being said, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Robert Diggings.
I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Robert, I am thrilled to be with you today. Ever since we met a number of months ago, actually it was online, I was just really excited to hear about the work you're up to. So we're going to dive into that today. How are you, first of all?
I'm really well, and I'm delighted to be in conversation with you, Joel. Thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah, one of the things that made me so excited was when you talked about the work you do as a coach and you know, how in demand you are. And I just thought, wow, what an opportunity to unpack it from lots of different angles. Like, what are you up to with the people you coach? So could you actually just begin by giving us a sense of the work you're doing as a coach?
Definitely. And if, in fact, I might even say, I don't know that I'm a coach, but we can explore that in this conversation. I definitely see coaching as an activity, but I would question whether it's a role, perhaps, maybe just because of the way I approach my work. So I'm definitely a practitioner, Joel, and I see myself as a team development practitioner. And that does involve some coaching, but it involves other things as well. So I wouldn't, my clients tend to say, Robert's our team coach. I would never say that. I would say I'm a team development consultant, and I'm a practicing team development consultant. So I not only have thoughts about the theory of that, but I meet with teams and sit with them and do stuff with them. I have done a lot of coaching in my time. I've probably been coaching for about 20 years as working as an exec coach. So I have done thousands of hours of one-to-one coaching work. But over the last 15 years or so, I have developed a specialism, I guess. I think I know quite a lot about this subject. And my specialism is around working with teams as a practitioner to help teams explore their teamliness with an orientation, of course, to it's hard, the words are not ideal, but to improve that, or to the idea of a maturity journey. I hold these things very lightly because I'm not sure that they capture much of the truth of what's happening. But of course, I'm engaged by businesses who want to get better at something. And the thing that they engage me to help them with is to get better at being a team, whatever that is. And maybe we could explore possibly what we might think that is, or what I am, you know, trying to do. I love the idea that coaching, one of the things with coaching is that the people in the room are there to try and work out why they're there. And I would say that's part of my practice, is that I'm engaged to help or to be useful. But what that actually means for any particular team or group of people is something that maybe might be known at the end of the process, but possibly isn't really, it probably isn't really well known at the beginning, if that makes any sense, yeah. Joe.
Yeah,
it sounds like I don't know what I'm doing, and on one level, I don't.
I think that's also important, isn't it? You know, I think we can pick that up as a topic, not knowing what we're doing, because I think you mean that in a very particular way. Not that you just kind of blunder in and just make it up, but that not knowing is actually important. And I wonder, you said, and I can't quite capture the way you phrased it, but you said, you know, I'm kind of helping a team mature and improve, but actually, you know, that doesn't really capture what's happening. It's hard to put it into words, but what, you know, if you could speak a little bit more to what's happening within teams when, you know, when they mature, or after you've been working them for a period of time, what is it that you start to see happening with teams?
That's a fantastic question. So my practice is unashamedly a relational practice. So I'm very clear what I offer, and I don't offer the whole range of intervention that a team might need in order to become excellent. My practice is about improving interpersonal relationships in the team. But I would also say that I believe and have found that that is the thing that most teams, every team that I've worked with, get the biggest return on their time and money investment, is moving the dial on the quality of human relationship. All sorts of other things tumble out of that that are wanted and desirable in a business context. So it's a little bit provocative, perhaps, to say it, but I think that high-performing teams, the notion of a high-performing team, is out of date and no longer fit for purpose. It was fine for the 1980s and 90s for a team to aspire to be high-performing. I don't believe that's the case now, because performance is an output, and the world has changed. And so my orientation, or my way of expressing that, is to say, don't aspire to be high performing, aspire to be highly relational. So the focus needs to be on relationship, not on performance. And that then opens up, I think, our conversation, which is like, your question was about, well, what am I doing or what am I improving? Well, I'm improving interpersonal relationship.
Yeah, well, that makes sense to me, especially as, you know, it feels like things get a more increasingly chaotic or uncertain in our world. What is, you know, I want to talk to you in a moment about what you mean by improving the interpersonal connection and how you do that. But why is that important, do you think? And maybe could you share a little bit about how you often find teams? Like, are they disconnected? You know, is there a lack of interpersonal connection? And yeah, why is it important to be connected in that way in our times?
Well, I think that there are multiple facets to your question, or to attempt an answer. I think we are innately social. So we're social mammals, and we have evolved in relationship in hunter-gatherer tribes, in family units, in villages, in community. I think we get an enormous amount of fulfillment and joy and meaning, and possibly even our own sense of identity, through relationship. I mean, I might even say we don't really exist except in relationship. The notion of teams in business is, of course, not perhaps oriented around fulfillment and joy in relationship. It's more to do with, of course, commercial outputs or stakeholder outputs of some kind, or delivering on promises to other parts of the business. But what I think has happened is that completely unintentionally, we have sleptwalked into a corporate notion or culture where task and commercial output or business output has become the focus. And so in that, we have lost a lot of humanity in the workplace. And for me, the humanity is another way of saying that it is, we've lost the importance of human contact and the value that we have innately wired into us for relationship, for high quality relationship, for meaningful relationship, for relationship that matters to us, that gives us a sense of value and belonging, and a connection that matters.
Yeah, I'm very touched by what you share, and I'm imagining as well that as teams begin to find that sense of connection and meaning, there's a different kind of performance that can emerge. And I'm thinking also of you know, creativity and novelty and innovation as well. Yeah.
All of these things come, you know, it's possible to be, of course, creative on one's own, but in a team context, in a business context, creativity is a relational activity or a relational pursuit, that the best innovation comes from the colliding of different ideas, colliding of perspectives, colliding of dreams, out of which, as you've said, innovation or novelty or new ideas come about that can then be assessed and compared, and the business overall can innovate in some form. So I agree with you entirely that the innovation that so many businesses want comes from you know, there are different ways of looking at it, but from my perspective, they come from high quality relationships, high quality thinking, high quality contact leads to much better ideas, much better solutions to the challenges that all businesses and teams are facing now and perhaps always have.
And do you find that companies are coming to you? Obviously, they are in a way, but you know, because if I think about the times we find ourselves in and I hear certain stories, it's as if like one of the stories I hear is like people double down on performance. They double down on, you know, tasks and getting things done and you know, economic output. And so, you know, do you find companies are actually saying, no, we recognize that it's our interpersonal relational connections that we really need to focus on, actually? Or is it a bit of a Trojan horse? Do you find, you know, they like, as you alluded to at the beginning, they might not exactly know what they need. They need something. And then they find out as you journey together, it's all about this interpersonal connection.
The way I work and my approach is absolutely not going to work for all companies. Maybe only a small percentage, perhaps, would be interested in the kind of relational work that I do. So I don't think it's universally wanted. But there are, and I'm not sure that it's necessarily even wanted across a whole organization. My experience is that there are specific leaders who either intuit or want to experiment or have seen the benefit of improving relationship. And then they are much more likely, of course, to seek a practitioner like me than a more performance-based practitioner who might be very strategic, may be very valuable. I'm not knocking that at all, but would have perhaps an approach that is not so much about just the quality of the relationships that exist in the room. See, my view is that the team is the relational network. It's not the people. So, but that's an opinion. That's what I've come to believe about it. So, but it is a different way of thinking about what a team is, because it's very easy to think that the team are the individuals who sit around the table or in a circle. I would say no. The team is the relational web, and if you entertain that idea, then you can immediately see why, if you want to improve the team, you need to improve the quality of the interpersonal relationships, because I'm kind of saying, well, that is what the team is.
I mean, when you said every, you know, we're always in relationship, I think you said, and I think that's, we're moving out of an era where we, you know, we kind of atomized leaders and everything was fixed, you know, and separate. And now it feels, you know, I hear a lot of speaking of regenerative leadership and ways of doing business. And so what you're saying for me feels really aligned with that movement. And maybe we could dive in here to what you actually do with teams. Like, what do you find is important in you know, building this relationality? Like, how do you do that?
Well, it's so funny, isn't it? Because on one level, we all know how to do that. Everybody knows how to do that because we've evolved to do that. So it's more that the question might be more to do with, well, what stops that happening at work than the idea that, I mean, I kind of earlier said that I help teams develop or whatever, or my work leads to that happening. The greater truth would be they do it. I mean, I can't, none of us can really impact a relational system unless we're in it, and then we might be able to improve the bit that we're in and encourage others to improve the bits that they're responsible for. So I'm not sure. I think I might have sounded earlier as if I had some kind of power over teams, and of course I don't. And I want to make that explicit that, as with all coaching or this kind of intentional, conversational based work, as a practitioner, I don't think I have a great deal of agency. The client has the agency. I'm not imposing anything. Your question about the how is fascinating, and I can answer it in so the first thing is to say, well, maybe it isn't about doing something. Maybe it's about helping the team stop doing something or helping the people just come back to the value of relationship. I think we kind of know. I mean, maybe these aren't universal truths, but well, I kind of know, and I think most people would say that we kind of know that relationships are difficult and that they require continual effort. So if you think of a friendship or a family relationship, or well, any relationship, or a romantic, you know, kind of committed partnership of any kind, or a business, you know, a business relationship, a starters, friends who go into business or whatever. So we kind of know that relationships are, they're never done. We can't tick a box and go, yes, and we're fantastic friends, and that's it. The relationship requires no more attention. It's like, it's very easy to be fantastic friends and then not be. So it's a process, a continual renewal process. And so part of what I do is to remind people that. Another thing that I think we kind of know is that relationships takes time to form high quality relationship. And we haven't as a species really come up with a way of expediting that. Not in certain very specific contexts, relationship can be expedited. The military are very, very good at it, but they do it through very high levels of control of the environment and adversity to a degree that most organizations couldn't do either of those things. So the context of how Navy SEALs are brought into exceptional high quality relationship or special forces around the world is not a method really that's open to business in any meaningful way, just because, well, people would say, I'm not doing that. That's way beyond what is reasonable for us here in this restaurant chain or whatever. But we can still take some of those learnings around how we come to really love one another, to be, you know, in the military, to be willing to die for each other. And that might, you know, sounds a bit, it's true for people who are whose job it is to be under life and death situations. That's their job. So we have that capacity in all of us to love someone or care about someone that we would be willing to sacrifice ourselves for them, for their well-being or for their survival, perhaps. So how can we take that phenomenon and appropriately develop those kinds of relationships in a restaurant chain or a bank or a pharmaceutical firm, you know, in a corporate setting. That's kind of what my practice is about, is seeing the opportunity there that exists because we are a species of mammal that does this, have evolved to do this, and then so what can we do or stop doing in a business context that would enable or support those kinds of really high quality relationships to come about. That would be the starting point, Joel. And it's really having a client that's willing to invest in a process that will deliver that, which might not look very businesslike at the time of it happening, and it might not deliver benefit rapidly. It's a slow burn. You can't do this in a 2-day offsite. It happens over months, or probably in fact over years.
Yeah, I like the way you talk about the special forces as a, you know, an example. And I'm thinking of what, you know, one thing that they do is there's an intensity to the training. And I'm thinking, you know, of often in teams, there's maybe an intensity around productivity and getting things done, but there is often a lack of intimacy, a lack of intensity around connection, and actually, you know, an avoidance of connection is kind of just focused on doing stuff. And so I'm wondering if that's where there is opportunity for teams to create experiences where they're invited into intimacy, into connection that has an intensity to it, but that it's vulnerable, but that's where, you know, that's what human relationship is. I mean, so often we're talking about stuff, yeah, rather than about being in connection.
I couldn't agree more. What you've just said is my practice, and the intensity that is appropriate in a corporate setting is facilitated by slowing down, by silence, and by not talking about things outside the room. So if we sit in a circle and the instruction is just to talk about ourselves, so we're not going to talk about productivity, we're not going to look at a slide deck, we're not going to talk about the numbers and where we are on what we've got to do by the end of the quarter, which are all relevant to the business without a doubt, but they're not relevant to the relationships in the room. So it's a journey of, you use the word vulnerability. I totally agree. There's so many, there's such a paradox around vulnerability because it appears like it potentially is going to surface weakness, but what it actually does is create relational robustness or resilience or strength even. So it is, my work is, I guess, very invitational because you can't tell people to reveal themselves in a way that they don't want to. That would be potentially damaging, harmful, abusive even. But it is possible to create a space where if you're going to speak, so you don't have to say anything. So we'll sit in silence for 10 minutes. But if someone is going to speak, they speak about something that matters to them, about themselves, about their hopes or fears, or something that's worrying them. So it has to be, of course, interpersonal relationship. The clue is in the title. It's personal. So we need to share personal stuff, which is how we build friendship and how we fall in love and form romantic partnership. We take risk. We take interpersonal risk. We might start by saying, well, where do you live? And, you know, what do you like, red wine or white wine? Kind of things that don't matter that much. And then gradually over time, we might say something a little bit more where we might be rejected, where we might say, I was very ill last year. I nearly died. Or my sister lives a long way away, and I really miss her. It's painful that I don't see her anymore because she lives halfway around the world, and I only get to see my nieces and nephews twice a year. So as soon as we start sharing this kind of content, we are building intimate relationship, because that's part of what that is. And I guess that's part of what I'm doing with groups of people in a team, in an intact team, is inviting them to take greater interpersonal risk around things that matter to them, in order for them to show up more fully in the team and be seen more fully. And my experience is that people both really want that and really don't want that at the same time.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the spaces I'm in like that, where it's like, yeah, I mean, because being vulnerable is vulnerable. It's just, you know, yes. You can get good at, some people get good at being vulnerable, but then it loses its vulnerability in a sense, you know. And so, yeah, I can fully recognize what you say. And I'm just thinking, and it kind of tees up a question of, you know, a recent team meeting we had where someone shared what mattered to them, and it was about their connection with me, and it just dropped the whole space, you know, like it, and it created this quality of interpersonalness that was just not there before. I was really grateful this person took that risk. And so I'm just curious how that is for you, because it's, you know, one thing is, and it's important to share, you know, about my sister and I miss her. And then, you know, do you invite teams as well into sharing what's there between them? Yeah, that may be unspoken.
Exactly. Yes. So there's plenty to talk about as soon as you dare open the cupboard door. No shortage of stuff to talk about. The question is how to do it in a way that is doable, is possible, that feels perhaps a bit awkward, but not so awkward that we don't want to do this anymore. And of course, the appetite for this in a team varies. It's very unlikely you're going to have everybody have the same level of appetite for this kind of work. And if there's someone, even just one person, who absolutely does not want to do this, then it probably can't work. And that's okay. So in order for a team to do the work, this kind of work, I would say everybody needs to have a level of willingness. It doesn't mean that everybody has to share at the same level, but it does require everybody to be willing to be present to those who are sharing things that really matter, and to be willing to have a turn of doing that. But it doesn't mean that everyone has to share it in exactly the same way or at the same depth. But I think that there is a Yes, I think there's a need for everybody to be on board the process to some degree, or it doesn't work, because it's incredible how, even if, you know, 9 out of 10 people really want this, but one person doesn't, the power that person has on the whole system is quite considerable. And that needs to be really respected. And so it might be, well, we either need to go slower. That person may need some additional support if they are willing to be supported in taking part in the process. Or in fact, it's not, this isn't right. This isn't going to be productive, and it would be better to do something, you know, something different. And if I was in that situation, I might be able to do something different that still felt within, that it was within my practice, within what I do. Or it might be that I'm saying, well, no, this, I don't think this is going to work, and you need to probably engage a different practitioner who will work in a different way and support the team in a slightly different direction, or support the team to develop in a slightly different way. So this isn't for everyone, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful you named that. And I'm just thinking of an organization I heard of that actually made a real commitment to interpersonal development in a way that they said, this might not be for everyone. And if you don't want this, we respect that, and we'll support you to exit the organization if it really doesn't fit. And they did that in a very, you know, caring, supportive way, but also honored their commitment to, this is the culture we want to have now. And by the way, I hear it made a huge difference on their performance. Huge. So.
Yes. Exactly. So I'm of course, not against high performance, the pursuit of high performance, to my point earlier, the pursuit of high performance has some significant unintended negative consequences, whereas the pursuit of high quality relationships will deliver high performance and avoid some of the negative aspects of pursuing performance for its own sake. And that's part of my answer to your question earlier about, well, why, what is it that teams want now that perhaps they didn't want in the 1980s or didn't need in the 1980s? And I love what you said about your example of somebody in your team bringing, I think, if I understood correctly, Joel, their relationship with you into the, you know, to actually speak to that. Incredibly powerful. I mean, because then there is a turning of attention to the relationship, to a relationship in the room. And of course, in a team, there are multiple relationships. There are, the equation is the number of people in the team multiplied by the number of people in the team minus one divided by two. That tells you how many separate one-to-one relationships there are.
Yeah.
The equation is the number of people in the team multiplied by the number of people in the team minus one divided by two. That tells you how many unique one-to-one relationships there are in any group. And that number rises exponentially each time you add a new person, which is why larger teams are so much more complex from a relational perspective, because the whole team is having to manage many more one-to-one relationships. And my view is that, of course, a team member is responsible for the relationships that they're in, but their responsibility to the team doesn't end there. So if everyone in the team is responsible for all of the one-to-one relationships, because although if in a team of say 10 people, I've got 9 one-to-one relationships that I personally am in, and I can attend to those relationships. But there are a whole load of relationships that I'm not in, yet I can support the quality of those relationships, or I can ignore them, or I can do things either deliberately or inadvertently that are detrimental to those relationships. So I often do make explicit to a team how many one-to-one relationships there are in the room and ask people to consider how many of them they are actively paying attention to and attempting to support. And to finish that thought, I'll often say the way this team could rapidly improve its overall relational quality is if everybody in the team invested in the two or three least high quality relationships that they have, which is not what we tend to do unconsciously as human beings. We tend to spend more time with the people we have the better quality of relationship with, perfectly naturally. But if you really want to improve the relationships in a team, it isn't it's the relationships that are in the room that aren't being attended to that need to be attended to. So I would encourage people in the team to look around and identify the two or three people in the room with whom they have the least quality of relationship. And that doesn't mean that they've had a falling out or some issue. It just may be, well, I don't need to talk to that person very often. So my relationship with them is nowhere near as good as my relationship with Peter over here, because I speak to Peter three times a day. And it's like, yes, you do. But if you actually invested in the person that you don't need to speak to from a business point of view, you will. And if everybody did that, the quality of the overall relational dynamic in this team would massively improve. Again, and that links to my thing that the team is the relational web. So let's make that let's make the relationships better, and the whole thing lifts. The whole team will function in a different way.
I love you bring this in, because it actually brings up a question I'd love to ask you, which is your role as a facilitator or a coach, whatever, however you'd like to use that to describe yourself. Are you attuning to that sense of relationality in the team and naming what you see in a way that helps people, you know, maybe bring into awareness what wasn't in awareness before? Like what's your role in these times when the team comes together?
Such a good question. And I think the answer is it depends, which is a really good answer to almost any question that anybody can ever ask. yes, I do that sometimes, but I don't do it as a matter of course. So if it occurred to me in the moment that that was something that either needed to be made explicit or would in my best guess be useful if I named it. So if I felt moved to name something like that, then there's a very high chance I would. But it would be unpredictable. The same thing could kind of happen on a different day with either the same team or a different team, and I wouldn't. So I'm not convinced that there are easy answers to what is most useful. I think it's a slippery slope to conclude that one has developed enough as a practitioner to know that. I think it's more likely that we don't know that, or for me to at least own that completely, that I don't know that. I'm in a space of not knowing what's going to be useful nearly all the time, because it's very likely to be delusional for me to kind of go, oh, what I need to say now is this. It's like, you know, good luck with that. But it's taken me a long time to learn that, I guess. So, you know, I joked earlier about, you know, what am I doing? And I don't really know. And you very kindly said, well, you're naming that in a very specific way because you kind of you're right. I have some skill. I do absolutely. I'm willing to own my expertise, but perhaps a way to put it is that I am confident enough in myself, and not because I'm clever or talented, but because of the thousands of hours that I've spent sitting with teams, that I could not have helped but learn, unless I was completely not paying attention, something about what might be useful, or to have the confidence that if I can only let go of knowing, that I will then know what to say in any particular moment, as opposed to think that I can plan that. Or if you said to me in 5 minutes' time, X is going to happen, what are you going to do? My answer would be, I don't know. But when it happens, when the person bursts into tears, or when someone shouts at somebody else in the room, I have a confidence that I will respond to that appropriately, or if I get triggered inappropriately, but hopefully I will say something that somehow meets that moment, not brilliantly, but well enough, to be good enough. That's all that's required. A bit like parenting. As soon as, Joel, I'm not naming things that I think are universally true, and I'm very happy for you and anyone else to have a completely different opinion. But for me, I'm not attempting to be a perfect practitioner. I'm striving towards excellence and achieving something that's probably good enough most of the time, and that is good enough. This is fascinating for me, Joe, because you're getting me to say things and think about things that I have not necessarily ever articulated before, which I'm really enjoying. And I'm listening to myself going, is that right? Do you think that? Are you sure you think that? Well, I think it right now. Tomorrow, yeah. If you interviewed me tomorrow, perhaps I'd say something different. But this feels, I feel pretty congruent with what I'm saying. And it is a truth of some kind that I'm expressing to you.
But I think actually what you're saying is really important. And by the way, what you described about striving for excellence and being good enough, I feel that that does describe being a parent, you know, like the gap between my ideal and the reality is like the pain that I experience. But the big shift that came in being a parent for me was to see that and go like, you know, that striving for excellence is... So there's a difference between striving for excellence, which I think a lot of practitioners do, and that's beautiful. It's like that can be what drives us forward. And then pursuit of perfection, a standard we set against ourselves that's, you know, suddenly we used to castigate ourselves continuously. And so, and why I think what you've said is so important, actually, Robert, is because you're talking for me about mastery here, where yeah, there is, if you start to relate to group, especially groups of people, but even individuals, but with groups, even more so, you know, I've got a method and I'm going to, you know, take you rationally through this process and I know what needs to happen. That's not how complex situations work as I understand it. So what I'm hearing is that you're letting go of, you know, and part of facilitating in this way is like emptying out of what you think should happen and actually being present with what is happening and, you know, and responding. So, you know, your embodiment, the depth of your own maturation, you know, your own integration, so you get triggered less. All these things are actually playing out in how you're responding moment to moment to this group of human beings.
Exactly. And as soon as we strip away or say at least for this period of time, we're not worrying about the business or how we're doing from a business perspective, We're just going, how are we doing with each other? It is very beautiful. It's very freeing. And I see some people will really relax into that. It's like, oh, this is great. Oh, what a relief. But, you know, we've got a day or half a day or a couple of days where it isn't all about, you know, what the business needs or what our stakeholders need or what our investors need, or it's just about us. And some people invariably kind of go, wow, this is a bit slow. And when is it going to deliver? When is it going to deliver something useful? And that's also, it's a completely legitimate perspective. And I encourage those people to share that. You know, they'll say, this is frustratingly slow. You know, we've done nothing for the last 3 hours apart from check in. So I definitely know that I am attempting to slow the team down. I'm invariably doing that. I don't know that I've ever worked with a team where I thought what I've got to do here is speed them up. And some people find that delightful and others find it frustrating. But what's wonderful is when they express their frustration about it and say, this is, you know, where's the value here? And the value is cumulative. Well, like anything, like going to the gym or changing your diet or, you know, learning to drive. I mean, it's on one level, it's a skill thing for the team. So I used to attempt to answer or to speak to that thought. I used to, many years ago, be more than happy to do a one-off a team development offsite with a team. I don't do that anymore. I see no value in it. So my work is 12-month interventions or longer, because relationships, I don't have a way of doing it quickly. I don't believe there is a way of doing it quickly, because if there was, we would all know it and we'd all be doing it. So I don't think it exists. That doesn't mean that it can't be invented, but at the moment, relationship building, meaningful relationship, quality relationship building happens over time. And so particularly when I work with a new team, they may not really notice any difference that the work that I'm doing with them is having on them for 6 months plus into the engagement. So it's a slow burn. It's a slow thing before suddenly the team will go, we are so different to how we were 6 months ago. But they don't go, gosh, we're so different to how we were a month ago. It's like, this hasn't done anything in a month, hasn't done anything in 2 months. Oh, we're 4 months into this and I haven't noticed any difference. You know, what is this ever going to deliver something that we would all consider to be valuable? And then there's a shift that happens that kind of, you know, 7 or 8 months in for most teams, where they're kind of like, they can check in properly and not see the check-in as something that we've got to just get through to then do something to do the work. So I will say to teams often in meetings that if there is a check-in, and often there isn't in most business meetings, but if there is a check-in, it's something to get through to start the work, to do the work of the meeting. Whereas I'll say, this is the work, this check-in. And it might, you know, I've done check-ins with teams that have lasted all day. So that's what we did for the whole day. We just very, very slowly, everybody checked in and they took 20 minutes each or more. But to get a team to kind of see that this is the work, that normally takes a bit of time, and they'll initially rush the check-ins. It's like, you don't really want to know how I am. So I'm fine, you know, not, a bit tired, didn't sleep all that well last night. And then they'll move on. And then after several months of this, someone will take 10 minutes to explain how they are, what's going on with something that, not necessarily a bad thing, could be something really joyful, that, you know, something fantastic that's happened for their children, or you know, some really good news about a health issue that a parent has got. But it can also be painful things. This is, you know, I'm really worrying about this. And instead of just saying it and then quickly moving on, they'll actually unpack it. And that's beautiful. I mean, and it's so contagious. It's so permission giving to others. It's like, oh, wow, they spent, you know, one of their parents has just died and they spent 10 minutes talking about it. That gives me permission to talk about this thing that's happened in my life. Because that's what we're doing here. And that, I mean, it's incredible. It's beautiful work, but you can't make people do it. You can't go, what we're all going to do now is share deeply about stuff that's upsetting us. People, you know, we all just go, well, we're not going to do that, Robert. So think of something. So it's like, how do we take the baby steps, Joel, to get to a place where people can, well, like the example that you gave, go, I want to talk about my relationship with you or my relationship with so-and-so. That's not necessarily a quick place to get to, but it's a beautiful place to get to.
I'm so touched that you're doing this. And because, you know, even in a lot of interpersonal work, which can be powerful, there can be underlying it a sense of like, we're doing this to get to the performance, you know, to perform better. And that's not to say there isn't value that can come from it. But as I'm hearing you speak, it's like, no, it's actually really honoring that we're our humanity and that we are relational creatures and that we're not doing this for the sake of something else, even though we start to see the benefits. And I know you're in demand and, you know, people really want your services. And it's really wanted by organizations. And so I'm touched by that, actually, Robert. I think it's beautiful. And it's like, I think people are crying out for that, even if they don't know it. I think probably a lot of people wouldn't even be able to say it. But so I'm wondering, is it really in a sense about being with a, you know, over 12 months, you're with a team and, you know, it's about, we're going to continuously create spaces where people can share what's alive for them, even if that is about their interpersonal connection. And that's kind of the core of it, you know. It's like, just keep doing that, and I'm going to stay with you. Do you build like layers of practice in, or and then just weave in another question? It's kind of poor podcasting when I can't help myself, which is like, do you find yourself like helping people contact themselves emotionally at times? For example, if someone bursts into tears and then they, you know, it's like, hey, let's just welcome this, you know, or yeah, this is here too. The tears are here too. Like make it normalizing. Yeah. I'll stop there.
All of that. I'm encouraging people to bring more of themselves into the room, bit of a cliche, but that is what relationship is about. There are so many different ways of looking at it. We want to belong. Most of us want to belong. It can get disturbed, of course, through our very unfortunate childhood experience. But for most of us, there's a desire to belong. But of course, to belong is a co-created phenomenon. We can only fully belong if we are known, and we can only be known if we are willing to self-disclose. But even that's not enough, because we need to self-disclose to others who are paying attention and are wanting us, are wanting to hear us, hear our story, hear our hopes and fears and frustrations and pain, and share, you know, how we're feeling. So that even that phenomenon of belonging is about we need to be welcomed in order to belong, but we also then need, even if there is a strong welcoming of us, that isn't enough. We need to then accept the welcome and step into it and kind of go, oh, you really want me? I'll show up then. Um, And I go back to that. I don't believe I'm saying anything new here. I think we all, if we give it any thought, we can all work this out. We all know this because we are all in relationship, and we're all struggling and delighting in it, and we're in relationship to ourselves first and foremost. So we have an internal relationship. We have relationships with others. We have experience of being in some kind of holding system as a child that could be a family or an institution, or there could be lots of changes in that, how we are looked after as a child. But we're all in this. We are all, we're all having to navigate this, whether we like it or not, consciously or unconsciously. There isn't a choice unless you disappear and go and live in a cave. But even then, you're going to have to face yourself. So we are. There is a bit of me that goes, well, I don't know really what I'm doing. I'm holding a space. I mean, these are cliches, but I'm not really doing the work. I can't do the work for others. They're doing the work. I'm merely, I kind of joke to myself. In some respects, I'm just creating some space in some people's diaries because they could do this without me. They don't need someone to come and do this, but they will of course say yes we do, because we won't do this, we will avoid it, we will go, oh my goodness, there's something happened to you, yesterday, wasn't that awful, we can't do the meeting tomorrow, we're going to have to just face into some more task, or well, we'll meet but it'll be awkward, and you know, we might do it once and then we won't do it again. So in some respects, part of the value that I'm adding is that it gets put in a diary and there's somebody who we're paying to run this thing, and so we better all show up. So that I think that's very useful. And then if we can build on that and do something interesting, something that captures people's attention and maybe feels a little bit uncomfortable at times, and invites emotional expression, as you've absolutely just said. You know, we want laughter. We want as much laughter as tears, and as much laughter as rage or frustration, expression of frustration, and fear. I mean, I would say there are four main emotions that teams need to navigate and get good at, and they would be those things: joy and grief and fear and anger. Let's look at that. Who's angry today? Who's feeling angry? Who can speak to anger? Who can speak to grief? Who can speak to fear? Who can speak to joy? Let's have, you know, that's how we build relationship. We talk about those things.
Well, let me just say thank you, Robert. First of all, I really mean I'm touched by what you share about what you're up to, and thank you for being on the podcast. And I just want to ask, where can people find out about your work? I'm sure a lot of coaches listening will want to connect with you or see if they can discover your work more.
Thank you. So kind of you. So I have an ongoing presence on LinkedIn, and I'd be delighted to connect with anybody who would like to do that on LinkedIn. Just obviously search for my name. And to find out more about my practice, go to highlyrelational.com. And there's plenty of stuff there to amuse anyone interested in this kind of work.
Amazing. Thanks, Robert.
Great pleasure. Really enjoyed speaking to you, Joel. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches.
because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.